It's really a pleasure to introduce Tom Evslin, who is one of the people who's done, I think, incredibly important work in understanding how the whole network of the future will develop, but has a long background in technology, starting off in Vermont, and with a stint off to be Vermont's State Secretary of Transportation. If he wants to tell you about that, I'll let him do it. But Tom has been involved in tech for a long time, had a software company he sold to Microsoft, worked with at Microsoft, then went to AT&T, where he is the guy we can credit for the all-you-can-eat flat-rate internet pricing that he started with AT&T Global Service, the AT&T Global Net, was that what it was
called?
WorldNet. And which forced people like AOL and others into doing the right thing, and has written a terrific novel and all kinds of things, and has issued a challenge on his blog a few weeks ago that resonated with something that Jay-Z talked about in his Harvard Law Review article, and I hope Jay-Z will be here, because these seemed really resonant to me, and these two ideas, and so we invited Tom down, and we thank him for making the three-hour drive from Vermont today to do this. So, Tom Evslin.
Dan, thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me. I will be quick because I hope to learn at least as much as I say today. As Dan said, I have an idea and I have a challenge, but I certainly don't know all the details about how to make this idea work. The problem is to know what the problem is with net neutrality. Very quickly, because I know I'm preaching to the converted, why do we want net neutrality? Why do we want an internet which is neutral on the whole? David Eisenberg wrote the seminal paper on that in The Stupid Network. And the first three reasons are innovation. Very clearly, to vastly oversimplify what David wrote, if a network is built for certain applications, to optimize certain applications, then new applications are either going to be very difficult to write or aren't going to work at all on that network. And so in order to put new applications on a special purpose network, the application developer has to wait online for the network developer to decide that this is a worthy application. We know from the phone network how well that worked. That's not being critical with the GIMP technology they had. They had to build a network specialized just for voice. They did that. But we don't see innovation on that network. A perfect example of that is that our cell phones are many times more capable than our landline phones, even though our cell phones have to deal with being light, have to deal with battery power, have to deal with transmission, where the landline phones aren't encumbered at all. But because that network is such a special purpose network, you don't see exciting new applications. The internet, not to belabor the obvious, but the internet has fostered innovation because it's open, because it's application agnostic. So applications that the developers of the internet never dreamed of can still be developed very well on it. Not unimportant is the fact that a network which is not neutral, a network where somebody is making decisions on what should be carried and what not should be carried, is also not as good a network for freedom of expression. We're not talking about engineering now, talking about democracy and the ability of people to communicate. So a free network is free both for innovation, but also free for content of all kinds. Currently, I believe, and this is a debatable proposition, and perfectly good engineers will debate this one. My judgment is that the best way we know currently to use bandwidth is to have a network which knows nothing about the application, which is not frequency segregated or segregated in any way by application, but where the packets representing various applications just flow through the network, and if an application needs special handling for its packets, then the application does something clever out at the edge of the network to get that. There's debate about that, but I do believe that the overhead that a network incurs in trying to give special purpose handling to applications more than takes away whatever you gain in terms of helping those applications. There are objections to net neutrality. Richard Bennett wrote a very good cross-examination to my post yesterday, asking me a bunch of questions which should lead up to my being an idiot for espousing a neutral internet. One of these is...
Richard Bennett, by the way, is one of the famous trolls and provocateurs. He's in no way a serious serious seeker or academic or anyone with a, or even an engineer. He's simply a troll that I think has been put up to it by the telecom industry to raise doubts.
But he does state the telco case more eloquently than the telcos usually do themselves, and so it made a convenient forum for my answering the arguments. And some of them don't deserve a lot of time. You know, there's this nonsense about the carriers can't get a fair return unless they can somehow charge differently for different kinds of packets and for different kinds of services. And this whole thing, well, Tom, don't you believe that people need fiber to their home? If they have fiber to their home, don't the carriers have to get a return, or otherwise the carriers aren't going to put fiber into the home? Well, it costs more to get fiber to your home. That makes sense. I'm willing to pay more for more bandwidth. Unfortunately, I can't get it in Vermont, but if some monopoly would see fit to deliver it to me, then I would happily pay more for it. I'm not going to spend much time on that argument because it's specious. The next one is that Google et al. Get a free ride. He put it, do you think it's fair that all the benefit from advertising goes to Google and none of it shared with anyone else? Well, I'd argue that the advertisers must feel they get a benefit or they wouldn't advertise. That is content consumers. We get a benefit because the content is paid for by the advertising we get. And not incidentally, the carriers get a benefit because we wouldn't need megabits of bandwidth unless there was content that we were going to consume and unless there was advertising to pay for that content. The interesting thing is that there was a story that only the Wall Street Journal really picked up on, which is that Verizon made a deal to pay for content for their fiber network. And that's really more traditionally the way the world's been. I'm not saying that network providers should always have to pay for content, but in fact, content adds value to networks, and networks don't have value without connection and content. Another argument, and this one is at least a respectable argument, even though I don't agree with it.
You missed one on the advertising, and that is that occasionally, and especially when the advertising is good and well targeted, customers find the products that they want to buy and actually go buy them.
Yes, absolutely. David, you're right. an argument which is not quite as specious is that packet discrimination is necessary for high-quality services. And there are some people who believe that they can't deliver a high-quality video unless the network is aware of what applications are running and what the special needs of them are. Richard picked a rather unfortunate example to use in debating me. He picked voice over IP, and he explained to me what jitter is.
May I just say what I neglected to tell you about Tom? He started one of the first serious voice over IP companies in the world that was a wholesale voice over IP company, and of this he knows whereof he speaks.
Thanks for the reference. Richard is right in saying that jitter, that is, packets that arrive at frustratingly different intervals, is a problem for voice over IP because the human ear is very sensitive to that. Everybody told us that when we started ITXC, that we'd never be able to carry voice over the public internet. At the time we sold the company in 2004, it was the seventh largest carrier of any kind measured in terms of international minutes of traffic carried. Almost all of that traffic was phone-to-phone. That is, somebody picked up a phone, they made a call, their carrier handed the call off to us, we transmitted it over the public internet, always the public internet, to whatever country it was going to, hopped back onto the phone network, and it worked. Now, its working was a good evidence of two things. One, that David Eisenberg was right, that from the edge you can do what you need to do. The not every route on the internet all the time was suitable for voice traffic, but from the edge we could influence the routing of our packets well enough. We could measure how well various routes were working, so that virtually all of the time we could pick a route which had sufficiently low jitter to allow our traffic to go. Also, the devices and software that handle phone traffic benefited from Moore's law, so they had clever and clever jitter buffer handling, so they could make up for some of the delays. Packets get lost in the internet. Yes, that happens. You can't wait for them when it's voice over IP, but the software on both ends, knowing it's fine for the software to treat its own applications, especially when it does that, it could work. Now, so what it proves is in a very complex application that the internet was certainly not developed for, and that at first glance you would say it wasn't suitable for, you can actually do what you need to do to implement that application at the edge. Suppose that we'd have had to wait for the owners of the internet, most of whom happen to be phone companies, to implement the things that they thought that we needed for voice over IP before we could have voice over IP. We still wouldn't have voice over IP. We'd still have international phone rates that were over a dollar a minute. So this is an illustration both that you don't need to have a special purpose network and that there's a huge benefit in not having it because you can have an application which otherwise would be waiting online a long, long time, if not forever. David, yeah?
Do you know about the Internet 2 testimony before Congress?
Go ahead, Warren.
Okay. There's a second line of converging evidence that says that bullet number 3 is specious, and that is that Internet 2, which is research, perhaps the premier U.S. research effort after Bell Laboratories, they decided they were going to build the next generation of network. They went in with the mindset that they would need all kinds of discrimination to know video and treat it differently than voice and treat voice differently than data. So they had lots of PhD theses about how you do this correctly. And according to their testimony in Congress, in every single case, they found that just adding more bandwidth was cheaper and simpler and more effective than any of the schemes that they could come up with. So your experience with voice over IP absolutely complements the Internet 2 experience.
Right. In every case I've seen where I've been involved with a network or an Internet application, the simplest solution has always been to make all the traffic work better, rather than to try to discriminate. That the cost of the implementing the discrimination was always higher than the net gain from it. I can't prove that mathematically. There could someday be a counterproof, but evidence seems to be very, very strong. Okay, so we all agree that there ought to be a neutral internet for a lot of good reasons. The goal of what I'm proposing is to preserve an internet in the United States. And by the way, I'm being U.S.-centric here, not because I'm a chauvinist, but because we suck as far as the rest of the world is concerned, particularly for where we should be and where we were as far as our internet is concerned. The problem is here. I don't want to pretend it's a global problem because it isn't a global problem. There's no problem like this in the U.K., for example. There's a worse problem in China, but that's something else. So my goal right now is to preserve in the United States an internet which is equally open to all applications, regardless of who owns the network and regardless of who the application owner is. Note that this doesn't mean that all applications will function equally well on every network. I've been getting upset about various things with the satellite internet that I have at camp. On the other hand, I know that 700 milliseconds of delay is going to cost me something, and I know what the speed of light is. So this isn't a guarantee that every application will work equally on every network, but what we'd like to see is each network being equally opened to applications and not be more open to the application of the network owner than to other applications, particularly if the network owner happens to be a monopoly. This is very, very similar, by the way. I shouldn't have got off that slide so fast, to what's gone on with Windows, right? We say that Microsoft shouldn't be able to use its position as the dominant supplier of operating systems in order to advantage its applications. I would argue that AT&T, the one with the little AT&T, the big one, and Verizon shouldn't be able to use their ownership of pipes in order to advantage their own applications. I'm not saying they can't have applications, but I'm saying that they shouldn't be able to use their ownership of the pipes in order to advantage the applications. Okay, so the strategy, it's easy to have a strategy, but we're going to run it. I'm going to need your help on tactics, is to provide information to the marketplace. I'm hoping that this problem, this threat to net neutrality can be solved by an informed marketplace. If we find instances of discrimination, then they need to be publicized. And in fact, if we don't find any instances of discrimination, that needs to be publicized as well. If there is abuse, by which I mean discrimination, and if market concentration makes it impossible for the market to function, even given information, then I think we've established the basis for some sort of government action. I'm not, I know many people here are, I'm not pushing now for regulation or legislation on net neutrality because I think that there's a lot of dangers in that regulation or legislation. But if we find that, in fact, there is much evidence of actual discrimination, right now I think there's more fear of discrimination than evidence of it. If there's evidence of it, and if even with that evidence being public, the discrimination doesn't start, my tendency would be to say the first law we'd want to work with would be the antitrust law, because we don't need new law, and the antitrust law already exists. But if, once we know the magnitude of the problem, then we can judge what's the appropriate response.
Mark Cooper made an argument to me that because Verizon gives you a discount on your DSL if you have voice service, that they're already discriminating, they're already tying their voice to their internet access and making it easier to use Verizon voice than and de facto keeping you away statistically from using voice over IP. And it's worked for
same
me. I don't
with cable, isn't it?
What?
With cable television.
Yeah, cable TV the same. The very fact of bundling means that there already is discrimination because you're tying, you know, in the case of the triple play where you have voice, data, and video, and you get a discount if you buy all three, by already having the discounts on the video and the voice, which are applications, in order to get the data, which could get video and voice over it, that the very fact of the triple play, that is tying and it's discriminatory.
Could we table that thought for now? One,
sure.
Because I didn't think about it, and because I'm really talking about it.
It's a stunner, I never thought of it before.
I'm talking about technical discrimination here, because we don't need this effort to define price discrimination.
You're right, you're right.
But so let's table it. That's yeah.
It is.
I tabled it, so I won't even answer.
Yeah, go on. Okay. Don't let us.
So since we're looking for technical discrimination, the evidence of the price discrimination obviously exists. One way to do that is to provide users with tools to monitor the internet. All of us are connected to the internet most of the time, and so we can have lots and lots of eyes if those eyes are software. I think we need some experts once we have gathered evidence, or while we're gathering evidence from lots and lots of probes that are running on lots and lots of computers, to check the results, to draw conclusions, to perhaps drill down and run more definitive tests. I don't think we can automate the entire process. And I think separate from the experts, there's some need to have editors to publicize the results, to people who can put results together into a coherent story. So there's a couple of ways that that might happen. First of all, what are we measuring when we're measuring quality? Let me back off for just a second. In order to get enough people to run the tools, I've been thinking that we don't want to look just for discrimination, but we want the result of running the tools to be sort of a consumer's report map of internet quality in general. So a network can be low quality without discriminating in any way. It can be even-handedly low quality. Consumers should know that. And so people will get more of a benefit, will get a certain benefit whether there's blocking or not. If one of these things the tools do is let us build a map provider by provider, and also will encourage a good marketplace, encourage good providers to be good providers. So the tools will both measure quality and then measure discrimination as an aspect of quality if the discrimination exists. But even if there's no discrimination, we'll get useful data over what kind of quality to expect where. Mm-hmm. So what are the dimensions of quality? Upload and download speed, obviously. DNS speed, which often gets missed, but it's very important, particularly when pages now are put together from so many different sources. Latency, how long it takes a packet to make a round trip. Jitter, the variability in how long it takes a packet to make a round trip. Notice here I put lack of blocking as a quality measure, so that we want to measure that. Consistency, how consistent is the network in whatever it delivers. And uptime, how often is it really around? And this is the whole reason I even have slides here, so you can write on them and make more bullets. These aren't very interesting slides to look at, but these, just think of these as notes, and notes that I hope you'll feel free to add to. Where are these tools going to come from?
There are derivative that, well, you kind of said it, but there are another dozen or two dozen things that you can put up there, and qualifications and footnotes,
yes,
and different time constants and so on the previous slide.
Right. Although, okay, one of the reasons why we need some editorial, perhaps at the beginning and well at the end, is that the results won't be consumable unless they can be boiled down to relatively few metrics. They won't be usable to the person who's picking a network if we say, okay, here we've measured 1,000 parameters and they're all available to you now, good luck.
Uh-huh. But that's where some of the very issues are in what is network neutrality.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Because network neutrality could be discriminating on any of the quality dimensions.
Uh-huh.
One of the reasons why I put DNS in.
And on some derivative measures.
On some derivative.
David Passmore wrote about something where the percentage of access to the backbone started going towards 100% at one point, which wasn't actually captured in any of explicitly. I mean, you could say this was implied and that was implied, but... there are some very abstract sort of third-order effects that can really pose an application.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Use a technical term.
Yep. Where are these tools going to come from? It would be nice if they came from the application vendors or the network operators. Remember, they have the application vendors certainly have a stake in not being discriminated against and enlisting volunteers to prevent discrimination. Network operators who aren't discriminating also have a stake in proving that they aren't, and presumably a market advantage. I've been talking to some application vendors. I'm not as encouraged as I'd hope to be by early results, but I think eventually it'll happen. So I think one source of these testing tools, not the only one, will be the application vendors. Just get a little out of order here. I think it's absolutely essential that the tools we get be open source. One is the tools themselves might be prejudiced. So you have to be able to see inside them to know that they're not. Secondly, we want to be able to bring to bear as much of the techno community as cares to participate in the development and elaboration of these tools, and obviously open source is an effective way to do that. So I do think it's critical. I said should there, but I really mean must. Be open source, both for testing and verification. And they do have to be tested and calibrated. You know, tools can return false positives. We have to know how often a tool returns false positives or false negatives. The tools must be perceived as safe, and they've got to be tested for safety. After all, we want people to download them and run them on their machines. They're not going to do that if they think it does any damage. We have to be careful that the effect of 1 million people or 100,000 people running these tools isn't to bring the network down.
To create traffic flows that might be considered discriminatory against some other application.
It could be an insistence on service attack.
Yes. Good point. That's wonderful.
New three-letter acronym.
iOS attack.
All those people wanted to make sure I was okay. By stethoscope.
Before David gets to the second order on this, the testing thing has to not be a good host for viruses so that they can't be hijacked and used destructively or hijacked and caused to produce false results themselves. It would be great if the tool would return value to the individual user besides having network value. That is, if it helps me get my applications running well, if it helps me know why voice over IP isn't working on my computer or why video or file sharing isn't working, then that's an individual value, and I think that increases the likelihood that I'll run the tool if it gives me diagnostic value as well as having aggregate network value. So I run it not only because I'm a good citizen, but I run it because it helps me with what I'm doing. Jeff Jarvis sent me an email this morning. He knew I was speaking here. Apparently there was an announcement by an engineer at Black Hat this week that you've got it there, Doc?
Yeah.
Why don't you?
Dan Kaminsky. I'm making sure it's right. Yeah, August 2nd. Right. Dan Kaminsky will share details of this technique. It's a net neutrality test offered as a free software tool, which will eventually be rolled into a free software tool today at Black Hat USA Security Conference in Las Vegas. We'll tell whether computers are treating encrypted data in second class, it's okay. For example, the U.S. Congress is presently debating blah, blah, blah. He calls his technique TCP-based active probing for faults. He says that the software he's developing will be similar to the tracer internet utilities used to track what path internet traffic takes as it hops between two machines at different ends of the network. So there's more, but
great. So he says he'll have something in 6 months. I don't know if there'll be something preliminary before that, but that's certainly a step in the right direction and the kind of thing that you'd like to see happen and the kind of community that I think we can look for some good development from. We have to collect this information once it's being developed, and I think something modeled on what SETI has done so that the task of information collection and analysis is distributed as well as just the initial probing. We need to have people responsible for verification. If there's an indication that there's been blocking by a broad brush tool, then there still needs to be a drill down to see that it happens. I'm very sensitive to that because as I've been wondering whether my satellite ISP was blocking Skype, I see definitive statements on. So I go on the Skype and on the Wild Blue forums, and there are people say, I ran this test, and it absolutely proves that there's blocking. And then somebody else says, well, the application's working for me, but the test is failing. So then we know that the test is definitive, or the test is succeeding and the application is failing. And so it's not a simple thing to know that a test is really
testing. Maybe the test doesn't survive the latency either.
Right, yeah. Right. And... And part of the particular problem with Skype and why Skype might not benefit from this as much as other providers is that Skype itself, using a proprietary protocol, it's hard to imagine Skype contributing an open source tool which is necessary to debug the things that might happen to the protocol that they're keeping secret. But hopefully other vendors will, and hopefully Skype will find a way around that.
there are rumors that Skype's been reverse engineered, so it may not stay proprietary forever.
I saw a good slide deck on that. I don't know if you saw it as well.
No.
I'll find it for you if you want.
Okay.
It was convincing whether it was right or not. I don't know.
But unless you have tools for each that are application specific, you always run the risk that the test works fine in a generic sense,
mm-hmm.
and then they've got this deep packet inspection that finds the signature of a given application and blocks that specific given application.
Right. So you'd like to have a tool where you could sort of feed in the signature of the application and test that generically, and at the same time, I think you'd like to test the major protocols that are used. SIP makes sense, for example. You know, SIP being discriminated against, uh-huh. and then you know something. I think we want to be careful we have accurate information. The quality information I'm not as worried about, because I think if there are a large number of probes, then you throw away the outliers and just use normal statistical techniques to know that you're getting valid information. But if evidence of blocking is thinner than that, then we may have to do some active checking. We may consider these probes that lots of people are running as early warning signs and that do return a lot of false positives, and not publicize the false positives, but go out, or not publicize the potentially false positives, but go out and find out if there's a problem. Positive in this case, David, meaning that there is blocking. So we want to be very careful, because we don't want to be the people that cried wolf, that we start screaming about blocking on thin evidence. We want to really have the evidence there. Of course, my hope is that if it's known that there's an active community of monitors monitoring for blocking, they may not find anything because nobody may want to get caught. That would be a good result. It's not as exciting as finding the villains and bringing them to justice, but our goal is to make sure that we have an essentially neutral internet and not to punish anybody. But if there is evidence of it, then I think if it's happening, then I think we can have widespread enough effort in order to find it out. Once we do find out, after verification, what happens? I think we want the information to go out both through bloggers and traditional media. And Dan, you didn't jump on me right away for even making a distinction, but obviously I hope the distinctions are going away, and I don't mean this is an effort to perpetuate the distinctions. Mm-hmm. This is information, and whoever is good at getting information out ought to be part of getting the information.
No argument for me.
Okay, great. No, I mean, I'm really learning this from you. I would have differentiated more before. Jay Rosen's new assignment.net model may be a good one, and that's why before I had put possibly paid editors into parentheses. And Jay, if I understand what he's doing, is trying to deal with the fact that there's a valuable function that editors perform. Some people are very good at being editors and other people aren't. How do you get good editors on good stories? And I've had some preliminary discussions with Jay, so perhaps something like this could work with newassignment.net. We've got to be even-handed in reporting good as well as bad news. If there isn't blocking, then there isn't blocking, or if we haven't detected it, then we say that we haven't detected it. I think that for information that's developed here from the beginning, this ought to be information which is under a Creative Commons license. And the only reason I'm talking about any license at all is not to prevent its dissemination, but to have some control over information which could be damagingly, which would be irresponsible if it were both excerpted without a citation, right? That you take a sentence out of context, you don't give a citation so somebody can go back and get the rest of the context.
So an attribution non-commercial.
Attribution non-commercial, I think, would be the right.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I'd restrict it to non-commercial, actually. Yeah. I'm not sure what
the user's guide to.
Right. Yeah, as long as there's no...
I was assuming this would all go under a non-profit, so...
Right. But if somebody else picked it up and made it part of a for-profit thing, so what? As long as they weren't restricting anybody else's right.
Makes sense.
Yeah. That's a good point. I'm not sure what roles wikis are needed to put this effort together, but it's hard for me to imagine that there aren't wikis involved here, because the way we collaborate more and more of the time. That's not really a surprise. Sorry, I went a little bit longer than I meant to, but I'd really like to get your reaction and your ideas on how we can make this work. I think also we have an IRC line open. Should we say what that URL is in case people are on the webcast?
It, is IRC open?
Yeah, it is. It's on freenode.net, the channel Berkman.
Okay.
Freenode, channel Berkman.
Channel Berkman on freenode.net.
Right.
So anybody who's in the audience, on the webcast audience, can use that to make comments and suggestions, too. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Zittrin. Sorry to have arrived a little late.
I'm glad you're here, Jonathan.
I'm excited to meet you and to hear some of the conversation. Let me just work backwards. I'm very excited about the distributed app, the plan, as you call it. We've sort of independently invented the idea here, no doubt with convergences of the same concerns, the same thought of a solution. Even the idea that it might have people thinking of themselves more as netizens than as just consumers of a pipe and taking an active role in maintaining it open, an insistence on service model, is very appealing. Just a couple questions on the app that I know as we've been thinking about it, both for these purposes, for the very closely related purposes of measuring filtering in China, outright blocks. It's really sort of the same task. And for the less closely related, but I think still essentially the same notion of figuring out what code is good or bad to run by gathering demographics from multiple machines and see how they do when various combinations of code run on them. One question would be whether to measure at the network layer, basically to have something running at the operating system layer that's looking at the TCP/IP stack and, as you say, doing the equivalent of a traceroute, or whether, either alternatively or additionally, to park a measurement tool very close to the consumer's eyeball that basically is not trying to get raw statistics that can so easily misrepresent the actual quality of service going on with an application, but rather to get a measure of exactly what their experience is. And to do that, as you suggest, you would need some, maybe some cooperation from the application vendor, maybe not so much from a browser since they've got such convenient plugin models, or maybe an open API so that you don't have to persuade application writers to come along immediately, but there's some port open for them to ship data when they're ready. They can even be assigned a key, so it's harder to spoof data if you're not that particular application vendor, but they can then put the hooks in to direct, as they choose, data to this project to measure how well that particular application is doing on the network.
That makes sense. So if they are not interested at first, but then later suspect that they're being blocked, they would have something to plug into.
Yeah. Way. Is that our video phone ringing? Who's that? That was just...
Somebody Skype?
No, I'm under the table.
I think it might be that.
Speakers up here.
Is it in the speakers?
I think
then maybe it's the.
Well, I think it's the Polycom for which we should set up. Like, we'd love to meet someone from Morocco, but
I don't think it's.
The... Oh, they gave up. Okay.
Yeah, they'll try again. Don't worry.
Very good. On cue.
I know how these things work. The other question that is worth kicking around maybe is whether we want a mothership model, which is a study-at-home model, that people are all contacting a given address to ship over their data, which might have scalability problems,
right?
Or whether there's some way to implement this peer-to-peer such that the data kind of laterally crawls along the net just the way directory information on Skype apparently does, that would make it harder to crush and maybe more scalable, just more complicated at the outset to design.
Yeah, I think to your point that there are now a couple of good models, so you wouldn't be inventing that from scratch, that the peer-to-peer stuff does crawl along the network, discover other nodes on the network, and some of the techniques that are used are more open than Skype's technique, so that might, for ultimate scalability, that's certainly a good model.
I'd also see the consumer side app of this as a great way to model best practices for spyware, essentially, because this is a spyware application in shape. It's sitting on the user's machine, it's initiating conversations with faraway servers and sending data that, for instance, could well, depending on how you wanted to implement the plan, be URL data about here's where I tried to get and I couldn't get there, so that you could figure out if there was filtering going on at that level. And brainstorming along with the app ways to display to the user what the app has sent, what it is sending, sort of what's going on, I think could really be a way of advancing the state of the art for privacy and providing a model for all these other crappy applications that constantly have something in the system tray ready to receive an update or send something back. And just doing that right would be a great thing.
So it's really it's a transparency issue for the application.
I think so.
So
and
you're
how,
thinking of applications like your Word just crashed, we want to send
yeah, right.
Data to
click
Microsoft
here to view the report. And you look at it and it's like, oh, my first kernel dump. I mean, that's not informative about what is going back.
I have a thought, which is that given I look at what I do with Flickr, I produce far more than I consume. In fact, there is no such thing really as a digital photography consumer exclusively anymore. I think a lot of the way that the carriers, for good economic reasons so far, have essentially given us a non-neutral net if we consider asymmetricality, non-neutrality, which I do. It's a quibble for me, but I think it's important to, you know, speak about the user side or even the producer side. I mean, I think all sides are the same here. I mean, mm-hmm. An interesting thing is in the next year, this is something I got at CES back in January, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. We're going to see 1080p screens at home for under $1,000 at Costco. We're going to see camcorders like this for under $1,500 producing 1080i and 1080p. Mm-hmm. And people are going to want to be sharing those, you know. And there's going to be, ideally for the carriers, I'd like to make the case for providing more service rather than less, and of a kind they haven't met before, and they're in a good position to provide it. But in any case, I'd like to see testing that looks toward that kind of marketplace where everybody's a producer, everybody's a consumer, lots of new businesses are possible at this home and small business level that add up to a larger economy than the carriers could ever imagine for themselves alone. And so I don't know how to test that.
Download speed is certainly part of it.
It's certainly part of it, but absence of port blockages is another. Right. Know, latency is another. There are a whole bunch of them, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just I'm just looking forward toward conditions that these guys are not even imagining, and for that matter, our guys aren't imagining that much either. But the marketplace is going to present us with, whether we like it or not, as we have a more or less infinite number of independent video producers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and. Looking for places to, you know, looking to share this and sell it and the rest of it.
Good point. David?
Like Doc points out, one form of discrimination, the asymmetrical nature of practically every connection that we have, is right in front of our face.
I want to pick a little bone with that, just because I want to use words precisely.
Yes.
That discrimination is, I wouldn't call it discrimination. The reason is that if the vendor had an app, it would suffer from the same up and download speed difference as anybody else's app. It's not a discrimination against apps that aren't supplied by the network vendor. Right.
Correct.
It's
discrimination against. It's a very fuzzy distinction where network design ends and discrimination begins.
Yeah, but in this case, if it applied, I would say in a minute, if their application's got 1 meg upload and everybody else got 256k upload, that's discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
If they advertise it as 256 up, 1 meg down, we say, okay, that's not the kind of network I want to be on, but it's not discrimination as long as it is for everybody.
But aren't,
I agree with you, it's holding back the future, you know, it's not where we want to go. But,
okay, but if the carrier is the vendor, then they don't suffer from the discrimination.
If the carrier is the vendor,
In other words, if their app is coming from the network, from the center of the network, in other words, they're not going to suffer.
Client side.
Oh, that's an interesting. Most app suppliers are connected symmetrically. Most major app suppliers, right? Because they buy commercial connections and they're symmetric. But you're saying that in a sense, the consumer who's also the supplier is discriminated against. I think that's an interesting point. At the moment, it's not something that needs to be investigated. It may well be something that needs to be discussed. The only reason I'm saying it doesn't need to be investigated is it's open.
Here's my larger point, is that I think having a tool like this is great, and but notwithstanding that, I believe that the most pernicious forms of discrimination are going to arrive in the light of day under the form of we're protecting the children, or it's for national security, or it's a quality of service fee that everybody has. We're not discriminating. It's the quality of service that, you know, or whatever it is. Everybody that gets Google has to pay this extra fee, or Google has to pay, whatever it is. It's going to arrive on your front doorstep and ring the bell. It won't climb in the back window, or it may climb in the back window, and this stops it from climbing in the back window. Okay. But I'm afraid that the really pernicious forms of network discrimination are going to be very much more obvious, like in China, where they just block Tiananmen, they block Falun Gong, and everybody knows it, and it's for the good of the nation.
My only argument, David, and it's not really an argument as much as drawing boundaries, is that certainly you and others have done a service in writing about potential abuses of that kind, that function is needed. It's one of the vigilances of liberty, really. It's not, and I'm talking about a subset deliberately that requires the monitoring. And it's not to say that the other isn't needed, but it doesn't require the monitoring. The open discrimination doesn't require the monitoring. We don't have to monitor to know that China's blocking. They said they're blocking.
Yeah, or that we need to pay $10 a month more to get a voice over IP unblocked.
Yeah, and I'm doing is suggesting that that's a broader question that you're looking at. And so there's
that is the network neutrality nightmare scenario that keeps me up at night. It's not the covert blocking. It's really the overt business decision that the telephone companies are motivated to make in the light of day to preserve their own business.
But that's already being debated, and that's a policy question that at least will be out front.
We have to keep it out front. I wouldn't.
That's the big one to me.
Yeah,
I promised I'd work backwards.
I'm sorry. Were you?
Daniel was waiting? Also. He was.
No, I don't need to get two bites of the apple before somebody's had one. So go ahead.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether this project doesn't serve the purpose David Eisenberg has just been mentioning, namely. It could create a certain, and I'm sure it will create consumer awareness, to use a business term, of the problem, and it might create a social norm that this behavior of providers is not fashionable and is not cool. And by this, if we start early enough, before all these marketing schemes and whatever discriminatory subscriptions will have a huge market share. If we start, if we can create this general sense early enough, there might be a fair chance that consumers won't accept these price schemes, and so.
I think that's a very good point. And, you know, it goes back to something that Doc said and somebody else said as well, that if we're netizens instead of consumers, if more
well, producers
people feel
as well as
if
yeah. Yeah.
So if we don't allow ourselves to, or if we bring, you know, probably the people around this table already don't consider themselves just consumers. They consider themselves participants. That's why we care so much about this issue. I think the more people that are involved in this, the more people that feel some kind of ownership, that feel some kind of control, then they're going to feel that it's their internet, that they have a stake in it, that they have a voice in it, and therefore that creates a political force against both overt and covert attempts to screw it up in one way or another. I'm a perpetual optimist, so maybe this is wishful thinking, but I think the participation is good, and I think that we grew up in an era where media meant broadcast, so it was one way, and that was the technology, and we live in an era where that's a vestige, really, and everything can be interactive, but we don't. That's still not our working assumption because of where we came from and because of the legacy that we're left with. There's an interesting political change that happens when everything's interactive and not just that there are passive consumers and there are producers and a huge gap between the two of them. Yeah.
So working backwards to the fundamentals of the net neutrality debate, I'm largely a fellow traveler on this, but I think we need to really create the best objections we can to network neutrality interventions and then figure out if we can overcome them so that we've basically got a really strong and not just an insular group that's advocating for it. So here are the two questions I've been struggling with trying to think it through. The first, I think, is pretty simple, and it's one you allude to on the slide, which is if it's possible to charge upstream suppliers to deliver bits to your local customers, then you could easily see emerging a business model where you provide free internet access to a bunch of people who couldn't otherwise afford it, and it basically gets subsidized by showing them ads by faraway content providers like Google. And I can hear people say, well, you know, if they can charge upstream suppliers, they just will and, you know, reap a higher profit and pay a higher dividend, but they won't actually, you know, get out there. But that doesn't seem to me a real strong response to the market argument that providing internet access to somebody that doesn't have it could make you a mint so long as you can charge the upstream suppliers. I'm wondering if you have a better reply to it than the one.
Well, I think there are two parts. One okay. is that if we had a competitive market for internet backbone and internet access in the United States,
yeah.
that's one of the thousand flowers that you would let bloom.
And this could help provide such a market.
Yeah. Well, but if the only people who are in a position to do this charging are the members of the duopoly, then it doesn't become a mechanism for extending service as much as a mechanism for shifting the profits from one P&L to another.
Yeah.
In the UK, there are experiments that go along that line.
Right.
And you'd like to say, you know, why should we make any rules at all? May the best network survive. Maybe I want to buy either because it's free or it has some attribute for me, a special purpose network that I get free along with one application. You know, why shouldn't I have the choice of buying that? And it's one of the reasons I haven't been for net neutrality laws or regulation yet.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that we want an internet in the broadest sense that as a whole is neutral. And in a competitive market, that doesn't mean there aren't special purpose subnets or even special purpose networks that are competing on their merits and on whether they can deliver better value.
Right.
But we don't have a competitive market in the United States. Part of the evidence for that is how expensive and how relatively unavailable broadband is compared to so many other countries in the world, in a country where the demographic creates a market for it. And so we can't afford to let the monopoly or duopoly suppliers create this network segregation. So that's one argument. Putting that one completely aside, the mechanism for doing what you say, that is, and this argument is going to, maybe you can help me boil this argument down because it ought to be simpler, but Google's connected, for the sake of argument, to four or five access providers. And their customers around the world, or their users around the world, are connected to thousands and thousands of access providers, and many backbone providers. So if Google's access provider is the one, so does Google have to have a relationship with every access provider in the world in order to reach the customers of that access provider? That's really unworkable. So that wouldn't happen. What would have to happen instead is a settlement mechanism so that Google's access providers paid per transaction to every one of the downstream providers. Now we're rebuilding the telephone system where the cost of doing that, both the accounting cost of doing that and the actual cost of measuring the traffic, and then the figuring out, did that, you know, with a telephone call, we had a model. If you placed the call, you were responsible for the cost of it, with collect calls being a special reverse case. Who's responsible when I ask something of Google? Is it me or Google? You know, who initiated this transaction? And will Google then have to say, well, I don't want your query because
you
never buy anything
much,
from
right.
the ads, you know? And so I think that the mechanism to implement that would literally break the simplicity and the application agnostic nature, and I'm speaking as an engineer now, of the internet, which may not be a bad thing from some people's point of view, may even be an objective, but they've never talked about how they would practically implement this charging Google, right? It's because Google reaches everybody through every access provider and every backbone.
Yeah, and most access providers would try to present a bill to Google and Google would tell them to go to hell. I mean, it would only be, and there'd be a different negotiation depending on whether you're Google on one side or whether you're, you know, a big ISP on the other.
I think, this is just me being a conspiracy theorist, but I think either unconsciously or consciously, what traditional telco executives would like is to get away from peering completely and go back to a settlements model like they grew up with in telephony.
Right.
And remember, in that model, they did get to charge both ends, right? They were charging you for your outgoing calls, but they're also charging access charges to the people who call you. So, you know, no wonder they're outraged that they can't charge both sides. That's a birthright.
Right. All right, here's the second question.
Yeah.
I
don't think I did very well in the first, but go ahead.
It's a tough question, I think. So I don't know. Second question. Comcast runs a coaxial cable to my house and gives me stuff that makes me slack-jawed with it. Like, that's their goal, and I pay them. They get to choose how much of whatever bandwidth is available on that cable they want to devote to cable television and how much they want to devote to broadband. And I take it that we don't, as network neutrality people, begrudge them that choice. If they want to put 10 more channels onto pay-per-view instead of giving me better internet bandwidth, that's their business decision to make. Is that right?
Yes, it is, but it's a very subtle point and a very good one that you're making, because you could say that we're discouraging them from architecting the kind of network we want them to architect. That we're saying that if they divide up the bandwidth by frequency, which is essentially what they do now, right? And say this much of it's for cable TV and this much of it's for internet access, then we're not telling them that they have to be non-discriminatory. They can do all the things they normally do in deciding which channels they carry. You know, there's a little regulation of that, but not too much. And then we're saying to them, well, if you do what we want, and if you do what we think the consumers really want, what would be the best way to deliver the service, which is put everything, just run a TCP/IP pipe in and let people pick the services that they want to pick, then we're also going to tell you that you can't discriminate, but we would have let you discriminate with the old architecture. I think is the essence of what you're saying. I think that the reason that that it's not necessary to work backwards and say, okay, let's end that old discrimination, is that I think that the marketplace is doing that. And I think an interesting thing that's going to happen with TV over the net is that the cable model is going to explode. You know, channels are a relic anyway. We don't need them.
What if they make channel 599 the internet browser channel, and you tune to that channel through your cable box, and they encourage you to use your remote control to point and click to stuff that looks suspiciously like the World Wide Web and in fact is.
And
at
then,
that point, they've blown up network neutrality, not by taking the internet that they offer through their broadband and breaking it, but by taking their brain-dead cable TV that they offer in the other half and making it a little smarter, but still control, basically, the experience. They're giving you a browser on channel 599. You can take a little IR keyboard and surf away. You can blog, you can...
Web TV.
Watch, yeah, web TV, basically.
Well, but I think then...
For less than $300 million, billion dollars, was that what you prefer?
I don't think that would escape the requirement to be neutral if there is such a requirement, because there's lots and lots of access methodologies for reaching the Internet, and we really talk about an Internet access provider as anyone who purports to give access to the whole web. Hmm. So I don't think from... I mean, again, I'm not proposing regulation or legislation, so it's hard to say how you'd write it to not leave that loophole open.
Right.
But I think your other point is interesting, that we come from a legacy of discrimination and of privately owned pipes, and that the Internet sort of snuck up on all of that, partly because nobody understood all the things that it could be used for. Even those of us who were Internet radicals didn't understand all it could be used for. And now we don't want to give any of that up, but I don't think we have to go back into the legacy world and retool it. That's certainly a debatable point, and it's a good point. Any other thoughts on that? Yeah, Doc?
Not on that in particular, but how would we like it if we had a locality, a city and a county, city 90,000, county 400,000, that wants to bring in the fastest, most neutral possible fiber to everywhere, surround it with a Wi-Fi cloud, and offer it as a flat service to put anything you want on it and not do the triple play thing. And we could tell it whatever we want to tell it to do. Because we have that in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. For free on the tax base, or how would you...
I don't know. We don't know yet. I brought it with James Salter, who's... is he about the biggest fiber installer right now? Or one of them?
He's certainly one of the most knowledgeable. James Salter is a third-party fiber installer. Third-party network builder. If you want fiber on your campus, in your town, or whatever, you hire Atlantic Engineering, which is
he's a contractor.
It's like you want a house built, you hire a contractor. You want a sewer system laid, you hire a contractor.
Who's
a
fiber plumber?
Yeah,
okay.
And so there
light,
are
a light plumber.
There are. Yeah. Probably half a dozen or a dozen companies like his in the U.S. Relative sizes, they're all small.
He's done 53 cities so far. Mm-hmm. Provo, Utah is probably the biggest. Mm-hmm. And all of them are doing triple play. All of them, once they get the fiber and start talking about the fiber, all of a sudden start sounding just like the carriers, and because that's where the economics are, and they're looking to pay it off that way. We brought him into Santa Barbara to talk to the city fathers and mothers and to the county supervisors, and they got religion in one move, and so they're ready to go. And great. So this is like a 3 or 4 day old information. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to me / us, whoever we are, to help them out. So I'm just putting that out there. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking for a test bed to do whatever we might want to do, and maybe to build a fully neutral network for the first time, I'm probably in a minority here, in not here, but there, in wanting to do the non-triple play, and just say, look, we're building roads. After that, the maintenance is real low.
So you're saying we're going to create the equivalent of dark fiber. You all light it up.
Yeah, we'll bring it to your house, and there'll probably be some administrative costs for having, rooms that with machinery in them and guys that come out to fix it when it doesn't work and stuff like that, or maybe we being the county, job it out to some company, or maybe we resell it to the carriers, whatever that might be. But the idea being that the county got religion on wanting to be way ahead of the curve and having this built out, that the Internet is the superset and everything else is the subset, and we all agree we hate the carriers. We have to suffer them in the interim. But after that, what do we have and how do we do it? And so we've got a little bit of a fun tabula rasa project here, if anybody wants to be
interested. And so much of the network neutrality thing hinges on intent as opposed to any specific technical network parameter.
When you're done, never mind.
Sorry, go on. That that it's that really what Doc's talking about is the only way to do it and ensure that it'll be done.
And, however, it's never been done before because all these other guys are doing it, you know, the old way, which is an interesting thing to watch. Like, I got religion from Barb Frankston about this yesterday, so they're all doing it wrong, and I tend to agree with him. So.
Right. So you're going to have Bob Frankston sidewalks, or not Bob Frankston sidewalks.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's a great analogy. You know, I think that if the marketplace is going to be able to cure any tendency towards discrimination, it's going to be because there are non-discriminatory alternatives in the marketplace. And I think that's what you're talking about building. That is, if we have enough examples of a neutral network layer, whether it's wireless or wired, doesn't really matter, but if we have enough examples of a neutral network layer, then the market will demand a neutral network layer on which applications can be built. And so I think what you're saying is that one way to improve and protect the internet is to work on these specific projects that are creating a neutral infrastructure from the ground up and
right.
demonstrating success with them.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far off what you came here to talk about, which was this application, which I'm really fascinated with and would love to help with. Do you have any sense of whether the fairly rapid development on wireless technology could bail us out of the duopoly problem?
I think it may. In two areas, and both of them independent, I think there is more hope than most people have in the mesh Wi-Fi networks. I've become what's it called when you're a phone FON?
Phonero.
I'm a phonero. Or I just got my modem, so I'll be a phonero when I configure it, because I'm interested in it. And I think that, you know, I wrote about it sort of tongue-in-cheek as America's anti-terrorism network, but there is nothing as strong and indestructible as a mesh network. And like the Internet itself is as a wired network, a mesh network of access points, particularly with small independent power supplies, would be an incredible thing in a place like New Orleans. And in fact, an ad hoc mesh network came up in New Orleans within a week after the catastrophe, which is a real tribute to what can be done. So I think that partly because it meets security needs and partly because it's good technology, that one way we may get there wirelessly is through some kind of low-power mesh. Another possibility is through the various WiMAX alternatives and the competition between them and EVDO version 2 and the other things that are coming out. So, you know, again, I'm an optimist, and I think duopolies are unfortunately stable. So as long as we have just cable and the old telcos on the wired side, I don't think we have true competition. But if we can add just one more element in there, whether it's municipal, whether it's a bunch of wireless suppliers.
A follow-up question to that. What do you define as broadband?
It's a good question. Obviously continually on.
Yeah.
And then I would say that it's up and uplink and Doc, I'm sorry for the asymmetry, but an uplink of at least 256K and a downlink 512 to 756. That's obvious, but I wouldn't stop at those boundaries because latency matters, you know, a bunch of other parameters matter as well. And the bar is going up. You know, I've been involved in an effort in Vermont to try to look at what do we need for broadband in 2010. Well, you don't want to look at what you need today because the websites keep getting re-engineered for whatever is available. And
as Korea moves to about 100 megabits,
right.
which a lot of folks who I talk to say, yeah, that's a reasonable definition of broadband, 100 megabits symmetric. Could wireless get there ever? Or is this going to take fiber, period, with maybe very short-range wireless?
I've seen some technology, and I'm getting beyond what technology that I'm comfortable with understanding, that's very clever about sharing diverse paths through a web connection. And so although the technical exit and entry bandwidth isn't 100 meg, for almost every application, because of very low latency and because of many alternate paths of delivery, for everything except trying to stream 100 meg stream, it's about as effective. Remember, most of us don't use our connection. Fast as it is, we don't use our connection most of the time.
So there'd be a lot of parallel connections.
There'd be a lot of parallel. Yeah. Okay. And there's even some technology which is sort of interesting that can aggregate various connections. So you can, in a sense, aggregate your neighbor's connections. Right. You still have some choke points. So I don't think we need... So I think the answer is yes if we're a little flexible in what that measurement means. That we could, that the applications that people support in Korea today with 100 meg, we could support on a wireless network, although we might support them somewhat differently.
Danny, your question. One of the reasons, one of the ways that we got to the decisions made the other day in Santa Barbara was a definition of broadband that went like this: full participation, sufficient to allow full participation in the internet economy, whatever that becomes.
Whatever that means. Right. So that's deliberately a
full participation was the thing. As soon as we started imagining what that was in all directions, then we realized that we really need to get fiber out everywhere to begin with, and then build out the rest after that.
Good point.
Internet economy? Why economy?
Just to, because makes business possible. One of the things that you don't get with the carriers is any business other than theirs. And they can't imagine any business other than theirs. And so what happens when you start talking to local elected representatives is they want more business in town. And they realize that, especially in a town like Santa Barbara, there are an awful lot of people like me, a lot of people in Hollywood that are working there. They really don't want to have to drive down there in order to use the Linux back end for the computer generated movies that they're making, right? Yeah. To do the render farms that are somewhere else, they want fat bandwidth, but they don't even know what that is. They know it's a lot. They're actually willing to pay for it, but they're not even getting it from the carriers, because the carriers can only imagine consumption at the other end of the pipe. So, what towns like Santa Barbara are finding is that there are an awful lot of independent professionals that are in businesses and engaged in activities that happen entirely or largely over the net, and could go into business. Like, what business is being prevented by the one business internet that they're getting from a duopoly right now?
I mean, I can see a strategic or rhetorical reason to focus on the business prospects and enabling businesses so that those who might not be wanting to spearhead what otherwise looks like industrial policy would be in favor of it. So I
it is
that.
An absolutely but, industrial policy. It's saying, like in Santa Barbara, we live in, say, in California's Maui. We really can't enlarge the roads going out there. 2 winters ago, all the roads were cut off. We were like an island. You could only fly in and out. So, and it's politically impossible to enlarge, to widen Highway 101. Right. The case is, well, why don't we build the future road infrastructure. You look at what the interstate highway system made possible. Well, this does it by orders of magnitude that are incalculably large as an enabling industrial policy. Like, let's put in the, it's pure infrastructure. It's like, let's put in the most capable infrastructure, the most highly leverageable infrastructure the world has ever known. And let's beat every other county in the country.
We already have the interstates. We need the local roads.
Yeah.
Let me because I know we're going to run out of time and we're going to run out of people.
This is about the time. So I think you should get the last statement and then we can kind of...
Well, actually, what I'd like to do is ask a quick question and get as many responses as I can. Is, if you agree that that the monitoring and collating that I suggested is a good idea, give me one idea each on how to get started, because I think that's the hardest part. Now, we can all agree that it's a great thing if it would ever happen, but we need to make it happen. So can I sort of get around to anybody who wants to start with an idea, and we'll stop whenever we run out of time? Doc?
Well, I was going to say I'd love to write all this up in Linux Journal immediately.
Great.
So let's talk about that.
Let's get a collaborative online presence together. how, in whatever form we decide, whether it's wiki or some combination of things, where people can start getting ideas down to supplement these.
What do you have an idea what that should be? Because it would be great if we could leave the room knowing where to rendezvous. Or do you want?
I mean, I could put something up.
Probably. Okay, great.
I think you need the net testing toolbox. You know, whatever that is, just a wiki that says that, and then populate it.
Okay.
Somehow that is.
But do you want to host that, Dan?
I could do that.
As a starter?
Do you want to just put something up at Cyber Stroke Netizenship? It's like a broad enough.
There we go.
Yeah.
I like that angle.
I mean, and then we can have it point to a wiki instance or a
That's great. We'll figure out the details after.
Okay. And do we have a way to all reach each other after this? Or everybody agree to look at Dan's blog?
You have five ways on here right now.
All right.
He's holding another one.
We have
some mailing lists. If you want to set up a mailing list, we can do that.
Okay. I just don't want to lose contact with all people who have been so participatory.
So everyone who wants to be on the mailing list, maybe mail Erica, George, the RSVP that you RSVP'd probably to come to lunch, and just say you want to be put on the netizen ship mailing list.
Great. I've been using BlockNot as a tag. Do we want to use netizen ship instead or
That's
in addition?
That's a horrible tag.
I think a positive. I think a positive, like, you know, working to the market, working to the strengths, trying to, you know, raise the bar in a positive way rather than beat up folks might be more.
I think netizenship might be a little broad.
Yeah, I think so too.
It sounds almost political, and this is rather technical, actually.
Yeah.
And it's hard to spell.
It's about connection quality.
Mm-hmm.
Equality?
What?
Conqual or yeah.
Boom. Well, this is actually a really
what do we call it?
Well, and represented in this naming discussion is a larger question about how broadly conceived the project is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would want to advocate for putting a political dimension to it, not a political dimension, a social dimension to it, especially because we recognize that to sell people on the idea of putting yet another running process on their machine, they might have to say, what's in it for me?
Mm-hmm.
And having them understand that it's part of a community they're joining, kind of the way that phone is so expertly, you know, be a phonero, you know, kind of thing. I don't mind that dimension myself, even as I understand that for some people, you might want to get off the bus just at network quality detectors and not necessarily at what's China filtering or what's goodware and badware.
So is free speech a major part of this in some sense? Or is that too simple?
I think it does. For me, it doesn't quite capture it. Free speech, I immediately start thinking of protesting on the National Mall and having your soap, and like that's a whole tangle that we don't.
Well, Doc's participation word is pretty.
The connection collaborative, perhaps.
Long for a tag.
Be a collaborator.
Wait a minute. It seems to me you've gone out of your way today to confine this as much as possible to the testable.
Yeah.
Right. That's right.
And
just because that's an element that I think is key, so we need to focus on. Not because I think it's sufficient in itself, but I think it's necessary.
Maybe we should discuss this on the list.
Yeah, so maybe this is topic A.
Oh, people united for...
Well, this we can call it.
Liberation of beings.
We can call ourselves testeros.
Yeah, I want just one thing on the testing versus other things. To go to Jonathan's sort of netizenship point, the first image that came to my mind was, if you're hiking, you keep the trail clean. You know, if there's brush down on the trail, if there's a blockage, you let someone know. It's sort of part testing and part activity that you engage in as a responsible user of the trail.
Testero.org.
Testero.
I like Testero.
That sounds like a new kind of Chevy.
I know it is.
It's a Chevy Testero.
Or something you take if you want to win a bike.
I'm sure testosterone is taken.
Testosterone arrows.
A name like that is a fun
testosterone arrows.
But we could have the female version. Estero.
Okay.
Well, wait, let's just kick this around a little more because this is a perfect thing to do synchronously a bit.
Yeah, right.
I wonder if we can build on it.
Yeah.
There, successful a generation ago were neighborhood watch organizations, mm-hmm. which had the same relationship of not being passive,
taking responsibility.
NetWatch is probably taking, but I think it's something spyware. Like that, right? Mm-hmm. That you're not a victim. It's like Take Back the Night and Neighborhood Watch and
it's sort of NetGuard as much as Watch.
Right? Yeah,
it's still defined defensively though. Yeah. It's you're inside your fortress. Right? And now, to be fair, I think Colin's idea is more like don't litter.
No, but he said also report a spill.
More than that.
You pick up the bottle you see.
Yeah, clear the trash. More active than that.
I don't think it's much more active.
But yeah.
Pack out more than, leave it better than you found.
Right.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
Picking up litter isn't great fun.
Neither is hiking on a messy trail.
I think maybe we can solve it... But we should solve it quickly, and I'm not here necessarily. But I think what we've agreed is it's a community, whatever it is, it's a community spirit type thing. Yeah. It's an activist type thing.
Planet
out. It's more social than political. I mean, that is, it doesn't have a left-right taint. It has a responsibility for your neighborhood, but the neighborhood's big.
I don't know if this is going to help on a name, but the closest metaphor I've been thinking about when trying to pitch this is that for global warming, for too long, our ability to affect the environment outstripped our ability to measure what we were doing. And now we're not in that state anymore, except for some people in denial, but that being able to measure is so critical to understanding where we're going and where we should go.
That's a good point.
And I don't know if that helps on a name or something, but I think of it like that. And to me, what I also like about it is that it puts under the same umbrella the questions, why can't I get there from here? And is the software safe? Like, they both actually fit under that kind of measurement for the sake of the ecosystem idea.
Packet test and packet org, packet out, as in packing it out, or packet.
Packet out. I thought you were like
packetout.org is not taken.
Outing your packets.
I can't see why. I like it.
Well, yeah. I didn't get it.
Doc already got
too highbrow.
It's multi-brow kind of, but yeah. But pack it out, that's taken.
I got a question just as in terms of creating a social thing of how do you make this more accessible for that mythical common man? Or, you know, because this affects everybody, but at the same time, I feel like people like us in this room are the only ones that are really aware of it and how it affects them. So how do you, you know, your big list of like bandwidth and DNS, how do you translate those into how people normally use the internet and the tools and applications they use? So I feel like for a lot of it, you know, saying application agnostic, most people don't really care, like
right.
if they're using Flickr, if they're using PhotoBucket or, you know, Comcast photo sharing service. So how do you translate these sort of ideas into maybe not why they should care, but why it's important and why other people care about it?
Well, I think the first way you get people to use the tool is that it's measuring quality, and blocking is only one dimension of quality. Because they do understand more bandwidth. Why do websites build so slowly? Why can't I see certain websites?
Then it gives them a really cool screensaver. It like, tells them what other people can't see that you can. Here are the top five sites that others can't see. It's like, let me see them.
I assume net rate is gone, right?
Net rate? Org.
On the quality dimension, broadly and specifically blocking.
Taken.
I appreciate the American focus, but I think there's value to having it deployed internationally. If nothing else, because it would be useful for Americans to realize that we get crappier service than a lot of
the rest
of the
world. That's true.
And that what we define as broadband as 256K upload speeds is preposterous in most of, you know, kind of developed nations, right? So having some sort of benchmarking that was independent.
Yeah, the only reason I've been sensitive about that is when I've talked to European friends, for example, about net neutrality problems, they just laugh me off because they don't have problems.
It's interesting though, because if we could put a test or a cluster of tests and a metric into common parlance, then the neutrality debate is won, right? Mm. We don't have a way to talk about it even right now. But if people, it's like if it's something that's like tire pressure or you know, or therms, or you know, I mean, you know, we have refrigerators now that come with ratings of different things on them. Like, why don't have some metric that says how clear the path is or neutral it is or whatever else.
You know, one thing that hasn't been brought up yet that... Oh, oh, wait a minute. I think that's taken. Yeah. The way back when, about 5 years ago, Mike Powell articulated four internet freedoms. And the fourth one was the freedom to know what your with the parameters of your internet service connection, mm-hmm. sort of a responsibility of the internet service provider to tell you you're going to get capped at this, you know, if you exceed this amount of downloading, and we are blocking port 25 and port 80 or whatever it is that you're doing. Just, you know, you could do it. The provider could do it all. But they had to tell you explicitly what they were doing. They had to say, for example, you know, 300 T1s are converging on the T1 that goes to the backbone, or whatever it was. That fourth freedom was eliminated by the Martin FCC, and it's now the four principles of record don't include anything like that, which would have been de jure what you want to do technically. So one of the things that I would argue is that, we should also be pressing to make this de jure thing, put it back on the table, and second, if you're not going to do it, we're going to do it.
And that would address Jonathan's concern that, you know, bring us into the political realm or the public policy realm. FourFreedoms.org is not taken.
FourFreedoms.org is not taken?
Maybe just want the fourth freedom or the missing freedom.
The missing freedom, it is.
Kind of malice.
Bad historical. Yeah.
But there are also the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, it's...
Nobody likes that.
You think it's tainted?
It's tainted.
Yeah.
5-year plan. Cultural revolution.
But actually, to play David Eisenberg, it's better to be measuring at the edge than to have the networks tell you how many T1s converge on one T1 anyway.
In the middle.
Right. That we don't. What we really care about is what's being delivered out to the edge, and not how how the network is engineered internally.
We could redefine IQ in terms of stupid, right? And others just think you could test for levels of stupidity. You can have an absolute stupidity where it's working perfectly fine.
Edgemeasure.org is available.
Right? Edgemeasure.org?
Yeah.
Edgemeasure is available.
That's pretty good.
There we go.
We may want to grab some of those, even the ones that are a little too techy, to use for subsets and subgroups, because we're going to be dependent on a bunch of techie people to do some stuff as well as a wider audience.
I mean, I'll grab it right now if we want it. And all of the edge measures are available, so probably the top three.
Yeah.
I'll just get them.
Okay. I wonder, is SETI...
.info.
Well, I was thinking just NetSETI or something. I wonder if SETI would care.
We're searching for unintelligent life.
Yeah. Stupid life.
I like that. I like that.
SETI. We want to make damn sure there's no intelligent life in that network.
I mean, it would be mad to, like, free ride on their goodwill. I mean, they've got a lot of it out there.
Except that, you know, well, if we said SETI to 100 people, even in Harvard Square, I'll bet 2 might know what we were talking about.
Yeah.
It's a hairy animal nobody's ever seen.
Yeah, isn't that in the Himalayas somewhere?
Lives in the cold, yeah.
But as soon as you say, you know, that screensaver looking for aliens, like, oh, yeah. So, you know, that screensaver looking for aliens.org.
All right.
All right, I think we have to wrap this up. Tom will still be here for at least a little while.
Yep.
So anyone who wants to keep talking is totally welcome to do that. But let's just take this opportunity to thank Tom for coming to visit.
Thank you.
Thank you all.